bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. I'm Ewan Rankin, and you've got me for the next 30 minutes or so on the week's photography news, and I'm going to answer your questions. You send them in to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. I read them out, and I'll give you the best answer I possibly can. We've got three doozies this week. The last one's an absolute pearler. The week's photography news is going to start in a moment, but first I want some feedback. If you want to leave us a review, you can do it in iTunes. We haven't had a review for a while. I've had a peruse around through a few of the iTunes store sites around the world today, and I've not found anything for the photo show. So if you sent me a photo review, tell me that you've sent it. Send in an email, and I'll read your review out. We could do with a few more, though. We haven't had one for a little while. So please review iTunes. Give us a review for the photo show, especially now it's changed format a little bit. That'd be really useful. Andy Vaughan reckons he's done his, but I can't find it at the moment, so if it comes up before the end of the show, I'll read it out. We've had an email from Dennis Wicheski. He was one that wrote in about Dennis's lug the other week, but he's written in about some of the stories from last week. Ewan, not only do I have lugs, but I'm a left-handed and a freak of nature, I guess. I'd suggest that the left-handed version of cameras would be more use than right-handed to right-handed people. The reason being, you've more control with your prominent hand. On a normal camera, this prominent hand, for you poor 90% of the population, is only used to press a button. The less prominent hand is used to operate the lens ring, which requires a degree of delicacy and accuracy. For us lefties, a standard layout camera is ideal. Our prominent hand dominates the focus, while our less prominent right only has a press button, and in the old days, a crank lever. Also, your less prominent hand is holding the lens at the point furthest away from the sensor. The point of the rotation for shake would suggest a lefty can hold a camera steadier than a righty. What do you reckon? You should, assuming you're right-handed, get a review model and give it a try for a few days. That's going to be impossible, Dennis, as I'll reveal in a moment. Also, left-handed peaks are supposed to be more creative, so perhaps the split in different in photographers. Straw poll of famous photographers, perhaps? Love the shows. Try when possible to catch live, but the interweb is a bit choppy for that and spoils the flow of the entertainment. Just wait for the podcasts. I'll do a review in iTunes at some stage. Thank you for the review, Dennis. Thank you very much indeed. As far as your question goes, I'm afraid I won't be getting a review copy of the Canon left-handed unit that I reviewed last week because that was an April Fool's joke. And if you listen to the carefully to the top of the podcast, I did say these are all the stories from the start of the week. So, of course, the first of the week was April the 1st. So the first lot of stories there are all complete and utter bunkum. None of them are coming. So thank you to a couple of people who've written in. I did write back in telling them that they were not real stories. Do apologise because some of them sounded like great ideas, didn't they? Twin-lensed, Carl Zeiss. Nah, not going to be cheap, is it? A 44 grand Leica. Now, that was plausible. You've got to admit. Oh, you had me, says Roarts. Adam says, I knew it was too good to be true. Yeah, sorry, mate. They were all the summary of the April Fool's jokes from the start of the week. Right, all the true stories. No April Fool's this week, of course. First one is from Nikon. You remember last week we said that they've come under a bit of hardship, bit of kicking from human rights or animal rights people saying that they shouldn't be doing rifle scopes. I mean, they're an optics firm. They do optics, and that's the end of the line as far as I'm concerned. They've issued a response to the outcry. The spokesperson said, Nikon makes lenses for a wide variety of customers. Camera lenses for photographers, microscopes that aid in scientific breakthroughs, and sports optics such as rangefinders for golfers, binoculars and scopes for outdoor enthusiasts. Nikon Sport Optics manufactures the product for outdoor enthusiasts and also respects legal hunting, conservation and wildlife management that meets local and national regulations. Nikon also values feedback from customers and the public. I've got to say, I'd have told everyone to piss off if it was me, but that's why I'm not in charge of Nikon. I'd have been a bit more blunt. But there's a good point there in the fact that there's an awful lot of scientists that are out there with dart guns and things like that, tranquilizing polar bears or rhinos and those kind of things, tagging them, doing an awful lot for conservation of species, and they wouldn't be able to get an accurate shot without a decent set of optics. So good on you, Nikon, for pointing out the obvious, and all of you namby-pamby animal rights lovers, bugger off, eh? There you go. Now you got my feelings on the subject. I'll get hate mail and death threats from that, no doubt. Ah, well. A war photographer has been has managed to escape. He looks just like my bloke, doesn't he? My war journalist I had the other week. This is 29-year-old photographer Pierre Bourgie. He was captured by organised criminals in Kabul on the 28th of November last year, and they sold him to people that they called insurgents, in inverted commas, in the article. They've claimed in the intervening period to be Taliban, Haqqani and Al-Qaeda as well. Bourgie was being kept in a crude dug-out hole in the floor that was covered with a trapdoor, but he eventually managed to escape by pushing off his chains and by escaping by means unknown, which they haven't said in the story, to a security checkpoint where he was taken by security guards to the Interior Ministry and then to the French Embassy. There was no comments from the French Embassy at all other than Pierre was in good health. So there you go. One of the brethren is free and at liberty. It's just a shame he's French. Never mind. A Wex employee has been in a bit of hot water and has been sentenced this week. An ex-Warehouse Express worker. Warehouse Express in the UK is a very big retailer. Excellent, excellent retailer, I have to say. The customer service is second to none. But one of their employees has been jailed for 2 years after stealing thousands of pounds worth of camera gear over a five-year period and selling it on eBay. Paul Coutred, 60, from Norwich, stole from the online photo jailer between the 27th of November 2007 and the 27th of September 2012. He sold the equipment that he stole, 15 pieces of kit, for £3,620. So he's not made an awful lot of money in that five-year period. And he was sentenced at Norwich Crown Court. It was far less than the amount that it could have fetched if he'd have sold it legitimately. He just tried to shuttle it on. Wex were unavailable for comment, apparently, but it's nothing to do with the store, is it? I mean, it's down to the individual there. If you are looking for someone to look after your photographic equipment for you, the two most recommended stores that I would put out, and I think Alex and would back me up on this, Calumet and Wex. They're absolutely excellent. Really, really, really good customer services. Well done. Project Gutenberg is a project that's trying to make an awful lot of old texts available, ones that are out of copyright protection, available freely. They're available down as EPUB books or generally publishing. You can get them on your Kindle and things like that. There's lots and lots of different formats. And they've released a whole pile of photographic books in the last sort of 3 months. And I think it was Petapixel actually fell across the story and said, you know, these are all out there, go and have a look. Titles include The Art and Practice of Silver Printing by Captain Abney and H.P. Robson. Fly Fishing by J.R. Hartley's probably in there as well if you want to go and look for it. And The Colour Photos of Birds from 1897 by the Nature Study Publishing of Chicago's in there as well. And finally, The Pencil of Nature by William Henry Fox Talbot. Now, if you don't know who he is absolutely seminal. They reckon that he was the first person to ever to create a negative and get to the idea of negative printing. And there's a picture of the oldest negative that's in existence. Obviously, that's the print from the negative, but that's still available. It's still out there. And he was down at Laycock Abbey in Ilchester. And if you haven't been down there, I do suggest that you go. I did some work in Ilchester many years ago. I think it's Devoney Way or South Somerset kind of thing. Go and see it. Laycock Abbey is where he lived, and there's loads and loads of stuff to see around there, including this image. But that is supposedly one of the first pictures ever taken with the idea of doing a negative. Fabulous, fabulous bloke. There you go. Those are all the stories. Just the general stuff. The stuff that's gone on. Stupid, stupid guy, says the chat room. And Adam loves the blue piece of glass on the bottom of the rifle scope. It's just a coating. I wouldn't sell your ass for it, mate. There we go. Products then. What products have come out this week? Well, it's been NAB, of course. National Association of Broadcasters, is that, I think, in America. We got one of our guys there. Chris Eschweiler's there for sure. And I think Jonah Max has gone out as well. But one of the things that has come out was Blackmagic. Now, Blackmagic, if you don't know who they are, they make a very interesting looking video camera. The current model is shooting at 2.5K and it runs via Thunderbolt, so you can link it straight to your Mac for downloading stuff. And it also takes SSDs via a SATA connection. So all you do is open the side up and slide a bare drive in, and that's what you record to. So forget all your SD cards and that kind of stuff. You're recording direct to the media that you want. You can put it in spinning media if you want to, but it takes an SSD. So for the sake of a 512 SSD, you're going to have an enormous amount of storage there, even at 2.5K. Well, they've come out with a new one. Blackmagic Design have come out with a new 4K version of it. Now, the camera looks exactly the same in terms of dimensions. It's a very weird boxy shape with a sloping back, curved edges, aluminium, you can see there in the image. Now, previously, you were paying about $2,000 for one of these, and I was really close to pulling the trigger on one of these last year when I started shooting a lot of video. I thought it was going to be a well worthwhile investment, and I think it will be. The beauty of this thing is it shoots directly in Apple ProRes 422 or Cinema DNG RAW file, so you're getting a very, very high quality capture straight away. ProRes is brilliant. We're recording it today to go with Darren's advice, and this thing is a 4K Ultra HD model. Now you can get it with EF lens mounts, and you can get it also as well, I think, with Carl Zeiss lenses fit it. And there's another lens mount that you can get with it, and I'm not sure what, but you specify it when you buy it. The Canon lens mount is obviously what attracted me, and it'll record 4K. It's got a capacitive touchscreen on the back with a built-in SSD that we've just said. The camera offers 6G SDI output, a Thunderbolt port as well. We've already mentioned that. Quarter-inch jack for mic and line inputs. I thought that was a bit weak, to be honest, based on the fact they could do digital or optical out, perhaps, on the audio. And it takes a 12-volt to 30-volt input, so you can have always on without having to worry about battery life and so on. It's a 3.5mm headphone socket as well, so you can probably monitor out of this, which is something that's missing very much from DSLRs. And a spokesman for Blackmagic, Grant Petty, said, "Customers have been asking us to design a camera with global shutter and a large sensor. With Blackmagic Production Camera 4K, we've delivered that, plus the high resolution needed for the latest Ultra HD production work." How much is it going to cost? Well, it's going to cost you $4,000, so that's a little bit up on from what the current prices of the 2.5K model, and it'll be available in July if you want it. One hell of a camera, says Adam. Yes, it definitely is. Whatever turns you on, says Windrider. Adam just likes things that are blue. Naturally professional targeted. I don't know. I mean, at 4K, you won't find a 4K camera out there under 10,000. You're talking about being at the very high end, aren't you, for the Canon stuff. So to see this in at $4,000 is pretty special, I think. And the fact that you can get it with an EOS mount as well for your Canon lenses, I think, superb. So will I be buying it? That's going to come out at £2,600. So that's about £800, £900 more expensive than the other one was. Do I need 4K? No, I don't. That's the difference. And do I need to worry about the processing time on my laptop and those kind of things? No, I don't. That's the thing that's really going to put me off it. The 2.5K will stretch me enough as it is. So it might be a purchase for the future. We'll have to wait and see. The other thing that came out this week, which was pretty good from Blackmagic, though, which I might be interested in, is the Compact. This is, it's a compact version of their big cameras. No, it's not. It's actually just a compact camera. It's a stills camera. And you look at all of the cameras that we looked at the higher end of the compact market in the last couple of weeks, and you say, right, they're about $1,000 to $1,200. Where's this one going to sit? Well, this one's going to sit in July as well as, and it's going to be $995. And it's a pocket cinema camera. That's what they're calling it. It's a new pocket-sized digital camera. It breaks the $1,000 barrier, which they're pretty proud of. And it includes powerful features such as super 16mm-sized 1080 HD sensor, super wide 13 stops of dynamic range on that, built-in SD card recorder for Apple ProRes, lossless compressed cinema DNG and RAW capture, and an active Micro Four Thirds lens mount. If they'd have brought this out with a Canon lens mount, they'd have had me money in a heartbeat. I think I would have definitely gone for this. One thing that is nice, again, if you just look very carefully on the side there, you've got audio monitoring out, which is huge. Instead of just putting a set of earphones in, you can monitor what you're actually taking in the video here. It's sitting there with a Lumix lens on, and Micro Four Thirds. You're going to have a vast range of lenses available to you. $995. I like it. I really like it. It's not really compact, is it? But I want to have a play with this, certainly. Whether I'm going to buy it or not is dependent on the play, but I really fancy it. I think it's a great idea. Stick that EOS mount on there for me, though. And it's a sale. There's no question. I'd be buying it as soon as it came out. But it's just the Micro Four Thirds. I haven't got any of those lenses. Come on. Come on. You can do it. Put the ears on. Something else that came from NAB was Tiffin. Now, Tiffin make a whole pile of accessories, and not bad ones as well. They do little screw-on lenses and things like that to go on the front of your compact cameras to give you wide angle and all those sort of things. They've come out with an accessory specifically for the GoPro. This thing is the Steadicam Curve. Now then, what's that? It's a Steadicam stuff. It's a Steadicam Curve for GoPro Hero. It's a stealth camera stabilization system. That's what the blurb says. It's engineered for the rigs of extreme sports and events, but it's compact enough to fit in your back pocket. The new Steadicam weighs in at 0.5 pound, so it's not insignificant at effectively a quarter of a kilo there. With an ergonomic design for one-handed smooth video capture, Steadicam is synonymous with action, so engineering a system that keeps pace with the intensity of GoPro users was a natural step in the progression of the Steadicam product line, says Steve Tiffin, President and CEO of the Tiffin Corporation. Availability and pricing, yet to be communicated. But effectively, this thing is, and I can only get one press release to read on this, but you hold onto it with one hand, and no matter how much you move, it's gyroscopically controlled and it will hold the GoPro relatively steady. I like the idea. What's the price going to be, though, chat room, eh, for you to take it? If you said this was $100, would that do it? Or do you need it cheaper or do you need it more expensive? There's the question. I'm quite interested in the compact camera, says Adam. It seems very tempting. Shame about the Micro Four Thirds as well, but still, for a compact body with connections, it's a hell of a deal. Yep. Not bad, especially for people wanting to use GoPros instead of DSLRs when they're multi-angle video projects. Good point. And Adam's come back and said that he reckons it's in the £70 to £100 market. So that's going to put it in the $100 to $150 market, I guess. I'd pay $100, definitely. It'd be a useful addition as well if you were slinging it under your helicopter, because that'll hold it really nice and steady. It gets rid of all your jello effects and stuff. Although I've cracked that if you have a look at the video on there. You look at Ewan Rankin on YouTube. I think I've cracked my jello effect on my helicopter. You be the judge. It's just low quality at the moment. I can't get over how crap the quality is on the GoPro. Maybe I need to get a proper camera underneath it. Like one of those EOS 100s. Saw one of those this week. It was very good and very small, but it's not particularly light, unfortunately. But it is smaller than the current ones. A lot smaller. Now then, Panasonic have released the Lumix GF6. What's special about this? The DMC Lumix GF6 is a compact camera system, unquotes, but it's got interchangeable lenses on the Micro Four Thirds system. It's got a 180-degree tilting screen at the back, and it's got 16 megapixels for improved low-light performance as well. It's got NFC support and Wi-Fi and a touch screen and all the right boxes, really. It looks really good. I think the actual camera and the lens setup in itself looks very, very nice. If that comes with, I mean, that's got a 3.5 to 5.6 lens on it. If the range of lenses can give you some basics, you know, a 35mm, a 50mm, 1.8, 2.8, and maybe something a bit longer up to 200mm and keeping the aperture range right down, then you could be tempted for this for a day out camera or certainly a project camera. Depending on the weight, you could end up putting it in underneath your helicopter again. You just fly it around the place. It comes with a 14 to 42mm lens, and it comes with an optional double zoom kit, which is a 45 to 150 lens. But there's no word on those two on what the aperture stops are. Records full HD video. There's no problem there. And it has a creative panorama road as well. Day-to-day photography in high quality is what the press release calls it. But I like it. I do like it. I'd like to have a play with this, definitely. Would it make me switch away? No, not professionally. I'm never going to use one of these professionally. But the wife's been looking for a little interchangeable lens. She likes the idea of the Nikon. I'm trying to talk her out of that a little bit. And we've got a Panasonic Lumix that she uses a lot. And that's extremely good. Takes fantastic quality pictures. So I'd perhaps get this one out and have a play with it. Price, it's going to be £499 with a 14 to 42 lens and £649 with the double zoom kit, the 45 to 150 mil. I think that's a good price. I think that's not a bad price at all. And Panasonic have got a very good reputation in the Lumix range for quality of image and that kind of stuff. I want to get one. I want to play with it. I want to see some more pictures. But to start me off, they've got me on price and they've got me on spec as well. Cheap and cheerful. I don't think it is cheap and cheerful. I think it's about the right price. They're not trying to make too much money out of it, says the chat room. Nikes this one a lot. Shame about the power zoom lens, but still love the design and a great sensor. Also, the video quality from the Panasonic is up there with the Sony's. Video could be a very interesting one with a little small lens on it there. That could be a really, really good buy. If they did it body only so you could go out and get some other lenses yourself, that might be nice too. We shall see. Next one is the Nikon Coolpix S9400. At the moment, this is around the £200 mark. 210, 212 is the kind of average price that you're getting. At the moment, cheapest is Amazon, amazon.co.uk, according to Price Grabber. This thing is a zoomed 18 times optical zoom digital compact camera. It's got 18 megapixel CMOS image sensor, which is going to be good because it'll be bigger for low light photography. 18 by 25 wide angle lens with lens shifted vibration reduction. It's also got full 1080p video recording and 7.5 frames per second on continuous shooting. 3-inch high resolution touchscreen on the back and a whole pile of shooting modes. It's going to cost you, according to the list price, £249.99, €294 or $299. It's available in black, silver, red and white. What do I think of this? It looks pleasant. I mean, it's very small, which is nice. The lens packs away neatly and it'll fit in a top pocket quite comfortably. Its features are not as much as other cameras that you get in the same price range, but it looks nice. Ease of use. On the review that I read, they said it was extremely easy. A lot of the menus that were on the back on the system were very, very good. And the image quality got good ratings as well as. So it could be extremely nice. For £200... It's in a lot of competition at that mark. And if you look at it, there's been an interesting article which was sent through to me by Pete, one of the listeners, before we started. A thing called the Wirecutter came out with their option for the cheapest and best digital camera on the market. Now, this is the Canon ELF 320HS. So the ELF and the Ixus range are the same thing. The ELF is the American version and the Ixus is the UK version. This thing retails at $140 in Amazon, so you'd be probably paying just under £100. I can't find the equivalent Ixus version in the UK. Whether it's not for sale anymore or not, I don't know. But this has won the Wirecutter's best cheap camera, Canon 320HS. It's got a 16 megapixel sensor. It's got Wi-Fi built into it as well and a touchscreen on the back. And it's got loads of other stuff. Apparently, there's another version of this as well, which doesn't have the Wi-Fi. And without the Wi-Fi, it drops the price down by about $30. So it's not a huge reduction. F2.7 to 5.9 on the lens itself. 1080p at 24 frames a second. 16 megapixel sensor, as I said. 5 times optical zoom. That'll give you 24 millimeters to 120 millimeters. It's a good little spec, and they're saying that it's not bad at all. And even if you shoot up at ISO 800, it'll give you very, very good quality images from there downwards. So it doesn't specify the ISO range, whether it goes any higher than that, but 800 is typically where you want to top out for most out-of-date cameras and small sensors. Anything more than that, it gets pretty chunky pretty quickly. I think it's good. I think it's really good. I'd like to get one of these and have a play as well. Because at that kind of spec, yeah, I'm happy. I could sling it under my helicopter. I've said that for everything today, haven't I, though? Chat room, I think I mentioned that you mentioned that the prime lens for the Lumix, you can get a 25mm 1.4 for $542.99. I presume that's both together, body and lens, not just lens on its own. And there's also a 45mm 2.8 for 720. Adam, is that for the lenses only? Because if it is, that's ridiculous. But we'll have to wait and see. Adam's going to come back to that. Oh, lenses only, £541 for a 25mm f1.8 and 45mm 2.8 is £720. That's stupid money. Certainly for the 45mm it is. Good God. I'll stick to my cans. I might be buying that 100. We'll have to wait and see. Don't tell the wife, though, eh? There's good boys and girls. Next one, IO Shutter. IO Shutter is a release cable that's going to fit to your iPhone. Now, it doesn't actually say whether this gives you any Wi-Fi capability as well as if your camera's got Wi-Fi built in. But this is a physical cable that runs from your iPhone to your camera and will allow you to trigger it. It's from Enlight Photo, and it's a DSLR accessory that allows you to remote trigger your DSLR using your iPhone or iPod Touch or iPad using an app that you've downloaded from iTunes. The remote trigger port is then used by a sync cable that goes in. It's not sync. I think it's looking at the cable. It's not a sync. I think it's a line input. And whether it can make the redundant. The iOS Shutter retails for £59 or $69. And me bloody count. Oh, bloody hell. Something's gone wrong with me bloody page here. I can't. I'll have to edit this bit. I didn't want any editing this week. Never mind. Apparently this will work with your 5D Mark II if you've got it straight away and your 5D Mark III. They tested the Canon version, so you get different versions of this for different cameras. And you can also use a thing called clap to snap and shake to take as well, which are other options. In what they said they used it for, it worked just fine. It's an awful big price, I think, for a cable. The cheapest you can get it at the moment is on Amazon at £44.85. Now, you're going to get an actual proper trigger for your camera for an awful lot less than that. I think I saw the Canon trigger for the 6D at £12 the other week on Amazon. So just so you can use your iPhone instead of using another cable, I think this is kind of pointless because you are tied to the cable. If they did a Wi-Fi version of this that allowed you to trigger off the Wi-Fi, that would be pretty special. But no, as it stands at the moment, not good enough. Won't be my recommendation anyway, and I haven't even played with it yet. That's the Canon news. Well, that's the news in general. Anyway, your questions. If you've got a question, send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. I'll read it out. I'll give you my best answer that I possibly can, or I'll refer you to someone who does know, and we'll see how we go from there. First question's from Matt. It says, hi, you and big fan of the show, as well as the Mac Show, Big Show, and iOS Show. Thanks very much, mate. My question is as follows. Last year, I decided to migrate from my Sony DSC-HX9V Travel Compact to a DSLR. I opted for the Nikon D3200 and bought it with a kit lens and a 55-300mm lens as well, as it was on offer before when I bought the camera. That's a big zoom. I also bought a 35mm 1.8G lens as I thought it would be a good thing to learn with, and have since bought an 18-200 lens on eBay. All lenses are Nikkor. I'm going to New York in a couple of weeks to visit family and plan a couple of days for picture taking in Manhattan. I plan to take the 18-200 and the 35mm lenses. Would it be worth me adding a polarizing filter to my kit for the trip? And any hints or tips for shooting architecture, tourist attractions, etc. I've got some reasonable pics with the Sony on previous trips, but hope to get some better results this time. Keep up the great work. I'm learning something new over regards. Matt. Right. Your 55-300 is a huge zoom, so that's going to get very soft at the top end in the last quarter turn, so probably from 200mm onwards you're not going to get anything that's worth shooting. 18-200 is equally bad, I would say, because of the range. If you know from your experience it takes really nice pictures, then fine, go ahead. But typically, especially with a turning lens, which I'm presuming that is, where you're turning a ring and you actually see movement in the lens rather than it just being internal, then you'll find that will get quite soft. taking it out to shoot with a 35mm, the 35mm will stand you in really good stead. There's tons of stuff you can walk around. It'll make you move as well, as we keep saying. Get a fixed lens. Do you need a polarizing kit for the trip? If you want to shoot into the sun an awful lot, and sometimes you don't get an awful lot of choices in New York, you know, you stand on one side of a building and you get the view that you get, and if it's south-facing, well, tough, that's the way it is. So if you're shooting down Manhattan from the top of the Rockefeller Center, you're going to be shooting south-ish for all of the shots that you have there, pretty much. And some of the better buildings, like the Chrysler Building, you can't actually see from the top of there. Empire State's a little bit different because you've got a north view there as well, more than the south view. North, I wouldn't worry. South, take a polarizer if you've got one anyway, and just have a play and see what it gives you, what rays it attenuates and then leaves. I wouldn't suggest that you need to worry too much about it. If it was a huge issue, I wouldn't take it, but if it's just a case of having it in a case in your pocket, then do it. Don't put it in your pocket because you get loads of bits all over it, and then you've got to clean it every time you want to use it. Keep it in its case. But yeah, stick it on the 35mm and see what you come up with. But I take the 35mm and probably use that 90% of the time, and then look to crop afterwards. The 18-200, it'll be good for some stuff, but I guess size is an issue with that as well. I haven't looked at the lens online, but I would stay away from it. Architecture, tourist attractions, etc. will stay away from the beaten path. If you go to Google and you put in New York tourism, and see what pictures it gives you, that will give you the pictures that everyone shoots. And everyone goes and stands underneath the Statue of Liberty and shoots up it. If you've got an opportunity, change your elevation. Look for offices, or look for places where they look like they've got high department stores and that kind of stuff. Use your circular polarizing lens to shoot through windows and attenuate the shine off those windows, to get different views. So Radio City Music Hall or something like that. Go to the shops opposite, go up to the second or third floor, and then shoot out and get a much better view of what you see. Typically, everyone shoots everything from the floor whenever they go on holiday, and that's where you'll get all the views. Look for something different. Look for a change in your elevation particularly. Go up to the top of the Rockefeller Center, and you're going to shoot everything that everyone else shoots, whereas if you go down on the street, get to different places, go from different locations, you should have loads of fun. There's loads of statues and that kind of stuff around New York as well. So again, you know, stand underneath and get very, very low. Change your height. If you've got kids and you're taking the kids with you, always try and make sure that you shoot from at least their head height or below. And that way the city dominates in the background and it starts to give you a sense of scale compared to the kids. There's nothing worse than a picture of kids where you've just stood at your height and shot down on them, because everything else just disappears. If you want to give sense of height, then you need to make things cut through horizons, to get the kid to stick through the line of the street, through the line of the building each time, or through the line of the windows, and you get a much more sense of scale. Get out and play, really, mate. Enjoy your holiday as well, Matt. Good one. Second question is from Vince. Hi, Ewan. I have a couple of questions for the photo show. I'd be grateful for your advice. Apologies if it's comprehensive, but it should avoid counter queries that you might have. Recently, I scanned in around 3,000 photos of my old print collection. Well done, mate. Mostly 70s, 80s, and 90s colour prints, 6x4, 7x5, etc., on a wireless HP NV110 scanner and the HP app into the iPad. These were then imported into iPhoto on a 2009 white MacBook, both up to the latest dated versions. I'm now going through the process of photo correction for colour and cropping, etc. I've noticed that on 3/4 zoom, and a lot of white spots are evident. These minor dust spots need correcting, and iPhoto has an excellent retouch tool. However, there are so many spots on some of the photos, clicking on each one is tiresome. The MacBook is struggling to keep up. I keep getting loads of beach balls. And the tool circle can only be enlarged over several spots if the background is uniform colour, otherwise you get smudging and artifacts occurring. Well, you'll get that with any of the retouch tools that you've got. The size of your brush is important because that's where it's sampling what's around it. So if you've got a dot or a blemish on a red background, you need to make sure that the size of your brush that you're sampling with and that you're painting with fits wholly within that area. Otherwise, you are going to get, particularly on the sample size brush is going to take in all of the blacks that are next to the reds, and then they're going to try and take those blacks and merge them into the reds, and you get a bloody awful smudging effect. If you've got spots on your images, the chances are, you know, I would say that white spots on your images, if they're that obvious, you've got two options. It's either you've got dust on the scanner, which, cardinal rule, always wipe your surface down. You'll have glass, hopefully, on the scanner, not Plaspix or Perspex. If it's glass, use an alcohol, because an alcohol will give you, nail varnish remover, something like that, will give you a very clean surface very easily. If you're talking about doing it with Perspex, then wipe it down with just a light soapy solution and dry it off. Just damp, not heavily wet, obviously, in case you get it in the electronics. But clean your glass first, and then also you'll get some cleaners that are quite safe for photography, acetone and stuff like that. Wipe over your prints and get all the dust off your prints that you can. Make sure they're all perfectly dry, and then lay them on the top. I'm not helping you here because you've already done 3,000 vints, but rule one when you're scanning photos is start from the ultra clean, and then you know it's not you. The other thing that you've got, there was a big trend in the 70s and 80s and 90s, or 70s and 80s more, of taking your prints, and when you printed them out from your negatives, you always had them done on matte paper because they look, you know, they didn't shine when you put them behind glass and things like that. The problem with that is matte is done by creating an undulation in the surface of the paper, and matte paper is the profile of it is a wibbly wobbly line. And the trouble then that you get is when you scan a hard light onto it, you'll get points of reflection, and those points of reflection will become white spots because they'll burn out, especially if you've got any kind of shine on the top of the surface. So there's no other way of getting rid of it. Once you've got it on there, mate, you've got to just sit and go through them one at a time and just take your time to get rid of them. You could have helped yourself, perhaps, I think, from what you've said, by cleaning first, but if it's not dust spots, if it's reflection spots, there's no way around that. You just have to deal with it. It just happens. It's one of the fortunes and pains. The other thing I would say is never, never, never do your prints if you've got the negatives. Always get a negative film scanner and scan the negatives and then invert them in Photoshop or something like that. iPhoto will do negative inversion as well. Two questions. The first one, is there a photo editing software that will do multiple white spot removal? No, there isn't, mate. It's a frame. It's just one of those things. You'll never get rid of it. Do individual spot corrections take me months of work? I prefer to keep in the Apple software family, but Aperture does not advertise this facility. You'll get nothing better out of Aperture than you already get out of iPhoto, I would say, to come into spot removal to a certain degree, because it's more aimed at the amateur market. You might find latest iPhoto tool is a better job because of the fact it's built for amateurs. It's built for that kind of error. Aperture's not. It's built for the pro a little bit more. And also, it's not been updated for so long, so it's probably going to be crap anyway. Second question, if each spot is meticulously removed and there are several hundred in some photos, is this increasing the size of the photo for processing? No, it's not. It should be exactly the same. There's no difference at all. The info panel suggests not, but this may be just advising the original size JPEG. Well, iPhoto doesn't use your original JPEG anyway. From what I understand, what you'll do is when you update the image, the original is saved, and then you get a versions that's in that. If you want to know where that is, have a look at Show Packet Contents. So right-click on your iPhoto library, go to Show Packet Contents, and in there you should see versions. You'll keep your originals in one folder, and the versions will be in another. It doesn't overwrite your original file, I hope. I know Aperture definitely doesn't. I'm struggling with disk space. I've only got 14 gig free and only 2 gig of RAM. Yes, I'm waiting to see what Apple new stuff is like to release. You could buy yourself 4 gig of RAM and max that out. Excuse me. I'm presuming that 2009 white MacBook will take 4 meg. Just instantly go and buy 4 meg. You'll probably get that for under 30 quid from Crucial. It's not even a thought process. In terms of software, so in terms of drive space, rather, you know, for 500 gig drives are going to cost you around £30 or £40 as well now. So go out and get yourself a dedicated photo drive. Get two of them, perhaps, and then bounce and do a backup using ChronoSync or something like that. But you are backing up, you say, in the thing. So there you go. Don't be a cheapskate, Vince, and make stuff sure stuff was clean before you do it, because otherwise I think you're stuffed. View scan can directly scan from negatives. It can't come soon enough. Everyone ready for the weekend? Absolutely. 2009 MacBook can take up to 4 gig of RAM. Yep, says Pete. Glad I got that right. I can't read the next bit. I don't know. Yeah. What was the backup software? My backup software I use is ChronoSync, and I love it. So basically, on here, I've got two MyBooks at 4 terabytes. and they mirror each other, but they're not set up as a mirrored RAID. What I've got is drive one and drive two, and I dump everything on drive one, and then just every day it compares drive one and drive two on an automatic function and just levels them out so that they've got exactly the same content. ChronoSync, I love. My big recommendation for backups. There's loads of other stuff out there, but I like ChronoSync. Gary Smythe has written in. Hi, Ewan. Love the show. You're doing sterling work on your own. Keep it up. Thanks, mate. I'm not a newbie to photography, but I have a question which, despite all my years of experience, I've always tussled with. How do you get around shooting images in a 3-2 ratio with pretty much every DSLR / mini DSLR and compact / bridge camera on the market? When it comes to displaying your images, you're likely to be tied to 6x4, which is, of course, not 3-2, 7x5, 8x10, 16x12, and it seems that none of the standard outputs at photo sites are the same as the 3-2 ratio that your camera splits out in that your camera spits out naturally. Does the amateur have to just live with this and crop as best they can, or is there a trick to solving the issue which you pros have kept to yourself all these years? Any help, advice, or words of wisdom are always welcome. Regards, Gary Grantham. Right, Gary of Grantham. I never print anything to an 8x10 or a 7x5 or anything like that. I take pictures for people and I frame the image and then I give it to them and they have the digital image that I've touched. And not very often now do I have to give it them in a specific size. They usually just say send the image and then they'll send away to a catalog manufacturer or they'll send away to a graphic design studio and they'll make the changes from the image that I've sent to them. I get problems with sharpening, and Alex and I were always going at this post-production sharpening should be done by the end generator. So it should go to the printer and the printer should sharpen the image to make sure that it matches their equipment. But they all bull on about the fact that they can't do it and I should be doing it, but it's rubbish. So I never do it. I never do anything for 8x10. The thing I'll say, though, is this is where your rule of thirds things comes in quite useful, because generally speaking, if you're thinking about, say, you're shooting a portrait of a person and you're putting their main part of their face in the upper third, right-hand side or something like that, and then it spreads across. As long as you keep that in the upper third of your 8x10 or your 7x5, the crop's going to change, but it'll probably still be fairly pleasing to the eye. At 7x5, your 3-2 ratio is nearly there. I mean, it's not worth arguing about the difference. But at your at 6x4, 8x10, and 16x12, they're very much squarer. They're much more towards 4-3 in terms of your size. So if your camera does 4-3, shooting 4-3, if that's what you want, and that'll see, hopefully should see what you see in the preview screen. Failing that, shoot your 3-2 knowing that you're going to lose a proportion from either side. And in your own mind, just give yourself a little bit of extra space. It never hurts. I mean, most cameras anyway will shoot about, what you see through the lens is about 90-ish percent or maybe more, 92 to 94% of what actually comes out in the frame once it's captured. There's a little bit of cropping naturally goes on because of the way the mirror goes in front of the sensor. So on that basis, you're going to get something that's slightly bigger than you shoot anyway. Just give yourself a little bit more of a border and crop afterwards. I mean, cropping's been going on since photo one. And that picture there of the latticed framework of the window done by Fox Talbot, I reckon he cropped that. I tell you, he cropped it. Cropping goes on. It's a natural process. People have been cropping since time immemorial. So give yourself a little bit of room. If you're thinking about the fact you're going to lose quality, well, if you've got something like Photoshop, bicubic interpolation will give you up to 140% of your original shot size without losing any quality, really. So you shouldn't worry. Shooting raw, and then you can blow up a little bit more and you'll save yourself a little bit more time when you bounce out to a TIFF or a JPEG. And also try and take what I do. If I did need to do that, I would create myself in Photoshop. I'd have the original image up. I create an 8x10 and I would output my photo as an 8x10 ready to print by 8x10. I wouldn't output a 3-2 image and then give it to the printer and say print that and then try and resize it afterwards. I always would want to print out what I actually thought it was going to look like in the end. That gives you the ability to play. There's no solution to it. The pros don't have a solution to that because pros don't shoot for frames particularly. They just shoot images that look nice and then give them away or sell them. Sorry, mate. I can't let you into the elephant graveyard there. Doesn't exist. If you've got a question, send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and mark it as a photo show question. I'll read it out. I'll answer it. There you go. Every week I do it. I promise. This podcast and all the rest is brought to you by UK2.net. UK2 is a great service for us. I mean, they do anything for web hosting, co-location services, domain names, anything for the web, UK2 do it. And they support this network. And by purchasing through our link from our webpage at britishtechnetwork.com, you get two things. You get to support our network and keep us on the air because UK2 give us our servers and they keep all of our bandwidth charges down. They don't charge us any bandwidth charge at all. It would be £500 for what we currently consume. And they're just wonderful. And they get lots of traffic from you guys, so you've been looking after them. Thank you. And you also get discount codes. And the discount codes will get you 20% off domain names. It gets you your first month off a dedicated personal servers. There's loads and loads and loads of deals in there. You can save a fortune. Please support UK2 because they support us. We'd be absolutely, utterly, totally lost without them. And the other thing is the Bash. Now, the Bash is coming up. I've got a competition for you in a minute as well, so listen up because there's a question coming. The Bash is coming up on the 6th of July. Tickets are £20 per person. It's not like it's Glastonbury or anything like that. There's no big show going on. There's no Bon Jovi aren't playing there or anything, as far as I'm aware, unless anyone's booked them. But your £20 is your way of helping the network to pay for the Bash. That's the way we see it. I also need you, if you can, to buy your ticket if you're coming sooner rather than later, because I've got to have an idea on numbers before I can book a caterer and a bar and that kind of stuff. At the moment, we're up to about 50 tickets sold, which is great in 2 weeks. I'm very happy at that. Thank you very much. But we could do with the place we've got can hold up to 300 comfortably. I would suggest that 100 to 150 is probably going to be the final figure, but I can't book a caterer based on that if no one's going to show. I can't order 150 people worth of pig roast and only 50 people show. So if you're going to come to the Bash, please get your tickets sooner rather than later. Don't leave it up until June or July before we do it. Once I know how many people are coming, then I can start booking people to come and provide us with beer and food and that kind of stuff. If you want to bring the kids, there's loads there for the kids to do. All the kids are free, but just send me an email after you've booked your ticket and let me know you're bringing any kids with us so, again, we can make sure that we cater for them. This is not me trying to make a huge profit for the network or get loads and loads of money in through the door and then run away with it. This is you paying for your proportion of the podcast, your proportion of the Bash, you know, the food and the beer that you drink, that's all. Also, there's a curry over the road the night before the Bash on the 5th, on the Friday. If you want to come to that, it's a 9 p.m. start and you need to buy a £10 deposit. Now, that's the banner underneath the one on the homepage that you can click at britishtechnetwork.com. Buy that separately, and what that will be is not a ticket for you get a free curry for a tenner. That will be £10 off your bill. And I'll send you a ticket and you need to bring that ticket with you to give to Milan, the owner. And when you give him the ticket, he will take £10 off the bill, plain and simple. They're going to split us up into, we're all going to be together, but we'll have like tables of four, tables of six, that kind of stuff. So a table of four will get £40 off the bill, a table of six will get £60 on the bill, providing they produce six tickets, that's all it is. Okay, so you need to buy that separately. But come to the Bash, because last year we had an absolute fab time. We had a band called Jam Folder came on, were hilarious. And I sang, and we did all the podcasts, and we got a fabulous quiz this year with Chiz versus the rest of us from The Gamer Show. It's absolutely brilliant. If you've not listened to The Gamer Show, the media show, the iOS show, or any of the other shows on the network, then you should, because they're really, really good quality entertainment. And that's not just the ones I'm on, that's the people that do the other podcasts. I think they're brilliant. I listen to The Gamer Show out of choice. I really do. Come to the Bash. It'll be loads of fun. Friday, the 5th of July for the curry. Saturday, the 6th of July for the Bash. Loads of beer, loads of food, loads of hotels in the Birmingham B36 and B46 area. Book yourself one in, and you won't be more than a fiver or so taxi ride from where we're having the location. It's a place called The Link down in Water Orton. It'll tell you that on your ticket. There we go. Come to the Bash. Loads of fun. Loads of people coming. We'll be back again next week with the photo show as normal. We'll answer your questions if you send them to us, and we'll have a review of all the photo news that's gone on. whatever it is. If you'd like to give us a review on iTunes, please do so. We'll read it out next week and give you some kudos for it. Thanks. So the competition. That one just reminded me I forgot to do it. Here you go then. The competition is very simple. If you would like a copy of FX Photo Studio Pro, that's about a tenner's worth, I think 13 quid's worth in the iTunes store. It's a photo studio editing application for your Mac. It's going to be on offer. Simple as that. All you've got to do is tell me where Laycock Abbey is. Send in an email telling me where Laycock Abbey is, and I will put you into a draw for a free copy of FX Photo Studio Pro. It's a great little application. They've given us a version to give away free of charge. So send it through to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and label it photo competition or competition and put in where is Laycock Abbey. There you go. Don't care, already got the app. Okay, you grumpy bastard, Pete. That's it. See you next week. Sorry. Thanks for listening. And follow me on @UinRankin at Twitter if you want to see loads more photo stuff. See you soon. Bye.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.